Chapter 6, Wyatt Walker. De rabbit is de slickest o' all de animals de Lord ever made. 1. The most famous photograph in the history of the American Civil Rights Movement was taken on May 3, 1963, by Bill Hudson, a photographer for the Associated Press. Hudson was in Birmingham, Alabama, where Martin Luther King Jr.'s activists had taken on the city's racist public safety commissioner, Eugene Bull Connor. The photo was of a teenage boy being attacked by a police dog. Even to this day, it has not lost its power to shock. Hudson gave his roll of film that day to his editor, Jim Laxon. Laxon looked through Hudson's photos until he came to the boy, leaning into the dog. He was, he said later, riveted by the saintly calm of the young man in the snarling jaws of the German Shepherd. He hadn't felt that way about a photograph since he published a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo 17 years earlier of a woman jumping from an upper-story window in a hotel fire in Atlanta. Laxon took the picture and sent it out over the wires. The next day, the New York Times published it above the fold across three columns on the front page of its Saturday paper, as did the New York Daily News, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, the Chicago Tribune, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. In the White House, President Kennedy saw the photograph and was appalled. The Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, worried that it would embarrass our friends abroad and make our enemies joyful. The photo was discussed on the floor of Congress and in countless living rooms and classrooms. For a time, it seemed like Americans could talk of little else. It was an image, as one journalist put it, that would burn forever. The thin, well-dressed boy seeming to be leaning into the dog, his arms limp at its side, calmly staring straight ahead as though to say, "Take me, here I am." For years, Martin Luther King and his army of civil rights activists had been fighting the thicket of racist laws and policies that blanketed the American South. The rules that made it difficult or impossible for blacks to get jobs, to vote, to get a proper education, or even to use the same water fountain as a white person. Suddenly, the tide turned. A year later, the U.S. Congress passed the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of the most important pieces of legislation in the history of the United States. The Civil Rights Act, it has often been said, was written in Birmingham. 2. In 1963, when Martin Luther King came to Birmingham, his movement was in crisis. He had just spent 9 months directing protests against segregation in Albany, Georgia, 200 miles to the south, and he had limped away from Albany without winning any significant concessions. The biggest victory the civil rights movement had won to that point had been the Supreme Court's decision in the famous Brown versus Board of Education case in 1954, declaring segregation of public schools to be unconstitutional. But almost a decade had passed, and the public schools of the Deep South were still as racially divided as ever. In the 1940s and early 1950s, most southern states had been governed by relatively moderate politicians who were at least willing to acknowledge the dignity of black people. Alabama had a governor in those years named Big Jim Folsom, who was fond of saying, "All men are just alike." But by the early 1960s, all the moderates were gone. The state houses were in the control of hardline segregationists. The South seemed to be moving backwards. And Birmingham? Birmingham was the most racially divided city in America. It was known as the Johannesburg of the South. When a busload of civil rights activists were on their way to Birmingham, the local police stood by while Klansmen forced their bus to the side of the road and set it afire. Black people who tried to move into white neighborhoods had their homes dynamited by the city's local Ku Klux Klansmen so often that Birmingham's other nickname was Bombingham. In Birmingham, Diane McWhorter writes, it was held a fact of criminal science the surest way to stop a crime wave, burglaries, rapes, whatever, was to go out and shoot a few suspects. "This thing's getting out of hand," a police lieutenant might say. "You know what we've got to do." Eugene Bull Connor, the city's public safety commissioner, was a short, squat man with enormous ears and a bullfrog voice. He came to prominence in 1938 when a political conference was held in downtown Birmingham with both black and white delegates. Connor tied a long rope to a stake in the lawn outside the auditorium and ran the rope down the center of the aisle and insisted, in accordance with the city's segregation ordinances, that black people stay to one side of the line and whites to the other. One of the attendees at the meeting was the president's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt. She was sitting on the wrong side, and Connor's people had to force her to move to the white side. Imagine someone trying that on Michelle Obama. Connor liked to spend his mornings at the Moulton Hotel downtown doing shots of 100-proof old granddad bourbon and saying things like, "A Jew is just a nigger turned inside out." People used to tell jokes about Birmingham of the sort that weren't really jokes. A black man in Chicago wakes up one morning and tells his wife that Jesus had come to him in a dream and told him to go to Birmingham. She's horrified. "Did Jesus say he'd go with you?" The husband replies, "He said he'd go as far as Memphis." Upon arriving in Birmingham, King called a meeting of his planning team. "I have to tell you," he said, "that in my judgment, some of the people sitting here today will not come back alive from this campaign." Then he went around the room and gave everyone a mock eulogy. One of King's aides would later admit that he never wanted to go to Birmingham at all. "When I kissed my wife and children goodbye down on Carroll Road in Atlanta, I didn't think I would ever see them again." King was outgunned and overmatched. He was the overwhelming underdog. He had, however, an advantage of the same paradoxical variety as David Boies's dyslexia or Jay Freireich's painful childhood. He was from a community that had always been the underdog. By the time the Civil Rights Crusade came to Birmingham, African Americans had spent several hundred years learning how to cope with being outgunned and overmatched. Along the way, they had learned a few things about battling giants. 3. At the center of many of the world's oppressed cultures stands the figure of the trickster hero. In legend and song, he appears in the form of a seemingly innocuous animal that triumphs over others much larger than himself through cunning and guile. In the West Indies, slaves brought with them from Africa tales of a devious spider named Anansi. Among American slaves, the trickster was often the short-tailed Br'er Rabbit. "De rabbit is de slickest o'er all the animals de Lord ever made," one ex-slave recounted in an interview with folklorists 100 years ago. "He ain't the biggest, and he ain't the loudest, but he sure am de slickest. If he gets in trouble, he gets out by getting somebody else in. Once he fell down a well, and did he holler and cry? No siree. He set up a mighty, mighty whistling and a singing, and when de wolf passes by, he heard him, and he stuck his head over, and de rabbit say, 'Get long way from here. Dere ain't room for two. Hit's mighty hot up dere, and nice and cool down here. Don't you get in dat bucket and come down here.' Dat made de wolf all de more restless, and he jumped into the bucket, and as he went down, de rabbit come up, and as dey passed, de rabbit, he laughed, and he say, 'Dis am life. Some go up, and some go down.'" In the most famous Br'er Rabbit story, Br'er Fox traps Rabbit by building a baby doll out of tar. Br'er Rabbit tries to engage the tar baby and instead gets stuck, and the more he tries to free himself from the tar, the more hopelessly entangled he becomes. "I don't care what you do with me, Br'er Fox," Rabbit pleads to the gloating fox, "but don't fling me in dat briar patch." Br'er Fox, of course, does just that. And Rabbit, who was born and bred in the briar patch, uses the thorns to separate himself from the doll and escapes. Fox is defeated. Rabbit sits cross-legged on a nearby log, triumphantly combing the pitch out of his hair with a chip. Trickster tales were wish fulfillments in which slaves dreamed of one day rising above their white masters. But as the historian Lawrence Levine writes, they were also painfully realistic stories which taught the art of surviving and even triumphing in the face of a hostile environment. African Americans were outnumbered and overpowered, and the idea embedded in the Br'er Rabbit stories was that the weak could compete in even the most lopsided of contests if they were willing to use their wits. Br'er Rabbit understood Br'er Fox in a way that Br'er Fox did not understand himself. He realized his opponent Fox was so malicious that he couldn't resist giving Rabbit the punishment Rabbit said he desperately wanted to avoid. So Rabbit tricked Fox, gambling that he could not bear the thought that a smaller and lesser animal was enjoying himself so much. Levine argues that over the course of their long persecution, African Americans took the lessons of the trickster to heart. The records left by 19th-century observers of slavery and by the masters themselves indicate that a significant number of slaves lied, cheated, stole, feigned illness, loafed, pretended to misunderstand the orders they were given, put rocks in the bottom of their cotton baskets in order to meet their quota, broke their tools, burned their master's property, mutilated themselves in order to escape work, took indifferent care of the crops they were cultivating, and mistreated the livestock placed in their care, to the extent that masters often felt it necessary to use the less efficient mules rather than horses, since the former could better withstand the brutal treatment of the slaves. Dyslexics compensate for their disability by developing other skills that, at times, can prove highly advantageous. Being bombed or orphaned can be a near-miss experience and leave you devastated, or it can be a remote miss and leave you stronger. These are David's opportunities, the occasions in which difficulties, paradoxically, turn out to be desirable. The lesson of the trickster tales is the third desirable difficulty, the unexpected freedom that comes from having nothing to lose. The trickster gets to break the rules. The executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the organization led by King, was Wyatt Walker. Walker was on the ground in Birmingham from the beginning, marshaling King's meager army against the forces of racism and reaction. King and Walker were under no illusions that they could fight racism the conventional way. They could not defeat Bull Connor at the polls, or in the streets, or in the court of law. They could not match him strength for strength. What they could do, though, was play Br'er Rabbit and try to get Connor to throw them in the briar patch. Wyatt, King said, you've got to find the means to create a crisis, to make Bull Connor tip his hand. That is exactly what Walker did. And the crisis created by Wyatt Walker was the photograph of a teenage boy being attacked by a police dog, leaning in, his arms limp, as if to say, take me, here I am. 4. Wyatt Walker was a Baptist minister from Massachusetts. He joined up with Martin Luther King in 1960. He was King's nuts and bolts man, his organizer and fixer. He was a mischief maker, slender, elegant, and intellectual, with a pencil-thin mustache and a droll sense of humor. Every Wednesday afternoon, he reserved for a round of golf. To him, women were always darlin', as in, I'm not hard to get along with, darlings, I just have to have perfection. As a young man, he joined the Young Communist League because, as he would always say, tongue planted firmly in cheek, it was one of the only ways a black person in those years could meet white women. In college, the historian Taylor Branch writes, he acquired dark-rimmed glasses that gave his face the look of a brooding Trotskyite. Once, when he was preaching in Petersburg, a small town in Virginia, he showed up at the local whites-only public library with his family and a small entourage in tow, with the intention of getting arrested for breaking the town's segregation laws. What book did he check out that he could wave in front of the assembled photographers and reporters? A biography of the great hero of the White South, Robert E. Lee, the Civil War general who led the Confederate Army in its battle to defend slavery. That was vintage Wyatt Walker. He was perfectly happy to be carted off to jail for breaking Petersburg's segregation laws, but he made sure to rub the town's nose in its own contradictions at the same time. In Birmingham, King, Walker, and Fred Shuttlesworth formed a triumvirate. Shuttlesworth was the longtime face of the Birmingham civil rights struggle, the local preacher whom the Klan could not kill. King was the prophet, gracious and charismatic. Walker stayed in the shadows. He did not allow himself to be photographed with King. Even in Birmingham, many of Bull Connor's people had no idea what Walker looked like. King and Shuttlesworth were equipped with a certain serenity. Walker was not. "If you get in my way, I'll run smack dab over you," is how Walker described his management style. "I don't have time for good morning, good afternoon, how do you feel? We've got a revolution on our hands." Once in Birmingham, when King was giving a speech, a 200-pound white man charged the stage and began pounding King with his fists. As King's aides rushed to defend him, McWhorter writes, "They were astounded to watch King become his assailant's protector. He held him solicitously, and as the audience began singing movement songs, told him their cause was just, that violence was self-demeaning, that we're going to win. Then King introduced him to the crowd as though he were a surprise guest. Roy James, a 24-year-old native New Yorker who lived in an American Nazi Party dormitory in Arlington, Virginia, began to weep in King's embrace. King was a moral absolutist who did not stray from his principles even when under attack. Walker liked to call himself a pragmatist. He was once attacked by a mountain of a man, 6'6", 260 pounds, when he was standing in front of a courthouse in North Carolina. Walker didn't embrace his assailant. He got up and came back at him, and each time the man's blows sent Walker tumbling down the courthouse steps, he picked himself up and came back for more. "The third time," Walker recalled later, "he caught me good, knocked me almost senseless, and I went back up a fourth time. By this time, you know, if I'd have had my razor, I'd have cut him." One famous night, the three of them, Walker, King, and Shuttlesworth, were about to preach to 1,500 people at the First Baptist Church in Montgomery when the church was surrounded by an angry white mob threatening to burn the building down. King, predictably enough, took the high road. "The only way we are going to save the people upstairs," he told the others, "is we who are the leadership have to give ourselves up to the mob." Shuttlesworth, imperturbable as always, agreed. "Yeah, well, if that's what we have to do, let's do it." Walker? He looked over at King and said to himself, "This man must be out of his goddamn mind." At the last moment, federal troops came and dispersed the crowd. Later, Walker would embrace nonviolence, but he always gave the sense that turning the other cheek wasn't something that came naturally. "At times, I would accommodate or alter my morality for the sake of getting a job done, because I was the guy having to deal with the results," he said once. "I did it consciously. I had no choice. I wasn't dealing with a moral situation when I dealt with a Bull Connor." Walker loved to play tricks on Connor. "I have come to Birmingham to ride the bull," he announced, eyes twinkling upon his arrival. He might put on a southern drawl and call in some imaginary complaint to the local police about niggers headed somewhere in a protest, sending them off on a wild goose chase. Or he might lead a march that wasn't a march, one that went around and around through office lobbies and down alleyways until the police were tearing out their hair. "Oh, man, it was a great time to be alive," he said, recalling the antics he got up to in Birmingham. Walker knew better than to tell King all that he was doing. King would disapprove. Walker kept his mischief to himself. "I think Negroes like myself have developed almost a mental catalog of the tone of voices of how a white face speaks to them," Walker told the poet Robert Penn Warren in a long interview just after the Birmingham campaign ended. "But everything that a white person says is interpreted by the nuance of the tone of voice, or maybe the hang of the head, or the depth of tone, or the sharpness of the tongue, you know, things that in the ordinary, normal, ethnic frame of reference would have no meaning, take on tremendous and deep and sharp meaning." Warren then brought up the trickster folk tales of the African-American tradition. You can almost see a sly smile cross Walker's face. "Yes," he replied, he found pure joy in poking fun at the master, telling him one thing that you knew he wanted to hear and really meaning something else. People called Martin Luther King Mr. Leader, or, in lighter moments, De Laud. Walker was Br'er Rabbit. 5. The plan Walker devised for Birmingham was called Project C, for confrontation. The staging ground was the city's venerable 16th Street Baptist Church, next to Kelly Ingram Park, and a few short blocks from downtown Birmingham. Project C had three acts, each designed to be bigger and more provocative than the last. It began with a series of sit-ins at local businesses. That was to draw media attention to the problem of segregation in Birmingham. At night, Shuttlesworth and King would lead mass meetings for the local black community to keep morale high. The second stage was a boycott of downtown businesses to put financial pressure on the white business community to reconsider their practices towards their black customers. In department stores, for example, blacks could not use the washrooms or the changing rooms for fear that a surface or an item of clothing once touched by a black person would then touch a white person. Act 3 was a series of mass marches to back up the boycott and fill up the jails, because once Connor ran out of cells, he could no longer make the civil rights problem go away simply by arresting the protesters. He would have to deal with them directly. Project C was a high-stakes operation. For it to work, Connor had to fight back. As King put it, Connor had to be induced to tip his hand, thereby revealing his ugly side to the world. But there was no guarantee that he would do that. King and Walker had just come from running their long campaign in Albany, Georgia, and they had failed there because the Albany police chief, Laurie Pritchett, had refused to take the bait. He told his police officers not to use violence or excessive force. He was friendly and polite. He treated King with respect. The Northern press came to Albany to cover the confrontation between white and black and found, to their surprise, they quite liked Pritchett. When King was finally thrown in jail, a mysterious, well-dressed man sent, legend had it, by Pritchett himself, came the next day and bailed him out. How can you be a martyr if you get bailed out of jail the instant you get there? At one point, Pritchett moved into a downtown motel so that he could be on call should any violence erupt. In the midst of a long negotiating session with King, Pritchett was handed a telegram by his secretary. As Pritchett recalled years later, "I must have shown some concern over it, because Dr. King asked me if it was bad news. I said, 'No, it's not bad news, Dr. King. It just so happens this is my 12th wedding anniversary, and my wife has sent me a telegram.' And he says, and I will never forget this, and it shows the understanding which we had. He said, 'You mean this is your anniversary?' And I said, 'That's right.' And I said, 'I haven't been home in at least 3 weeks.' And he said, 'Well, Chief Pritchett, you go home tonight. No, right now. You celebrate your anniversary. I give you my word that nothing will happen in Albany, Georgia, till tomorrow. And you can go, take your wife out to dinner, do anything you want to, and tomorrow, at 10 o'clock, we'll resume our efforts.'" Pritchett would not throw King in the briar patch. Getting Pritchett to do as they wanted was hopeless. Not long afterward, King packed up his bags and left town. Walker realized that a setback in Birmingham so soon after the Albany debacle would be disastrous. In those years, the evening news on television was watched in an overwhelming number of American households, and Walker wanted desperately to have Project C front and center on American television screens every night. But he knew that if the campaign was perceived to be faltering, the news media could lose interest and go elsewhere. As a general principle, Walker asserted that everything must build, Taylor Branch writes. If they showed strength, then outside support would grow more than proportionately. Once started, however, they could not fall back. In no case, said Walker, could the Birmingham campaign be smaller than Albany. That meant they must be prepared to put upwards of 1,000 people in jail at one time, maybe more. Several weeks in, Walker saw his campaign begin to lose that precious momentum. Many blacks in Birmingham were worried, justifiably, that if they were seen with King, they would be fired by their white bosses. In April, One of King's aides spoke before 700 people at a church service and could persuade only 9 of them to march with him. The next day, Andrew Young, another of King's men, tried again, and this time found only 7 volunteers. The local conservative black paper called Project C wasteful and worthless. The reporters and photographers assembled there to record the spectacle of black-on-white confrontation were getting restless. Connor made the occasional arrest, but mostly just sat and watched. Walker was in constant contact with King as King commuted back and forth between Birmingham and his home base in Atlanta. "Wyatt," King told him for the 100th time, "you've got to find some way to make Bull Connor tip his hand." Walker shook his head. "Mr. Leader, I haven't found the key yet, but I'm going to find it." The breakthrough came on Palm Sunday. Walker had 22 protesters ready to go. The march would be led by King's brother, Alfred Daniel, known as A.D. "Our mass meeting was slow getting together," Walker recalls. "We were supposed to march at something like 2:30, and we didn't march until about 4. In that time, people, being aware of the demonstration, collected out on the streets. By the time they got ready to march, there were 1,000 people up and down this 3-block area, lining up along the sides as spectators, watching." The next day, Walker opened the newspapers to read the media's account of what had happened, and to his surprise, he discovered the reporters had gotten it all wrong. The paper said 1,100 demonstrators had marched in Birmingham. "I called Dr. King and said, 'Dr. King, I've got it,'" Walker recalled. "I can't tell you on the phone, but I've got it." So what we did each day was we dragged out our meetings until people got home from work late in the afternoon. They would form out on the side, and it would look like 1,000 folks. We weren't marching but 12, 14, 16, 18, but the papers were reporting 1,400. It was a carbon copy of one of the most famous of all trickster tales, the story of Terrapin, a lowly turtle who finds himself in a race with deer. He hides just by the finish line and places his relatives up and down the course at strategic intervals so that deer thinks Terrapin is running the full race. Then, at the finish line, he emerges just ahead of deer to claim victory. Deer is completely fooled since, as Terrapin knows, to deer, all turtles am so much like another, you can't tell one from t'other. Deer had disdain for the lowly Terrapin. That was his problem. Terrapin was invisible to him. The underdog had to be a student of the nuances of white expression, the hang of the head, the depth of the tone, or the sharpness of the tongue. But there was no reason for the comfortable white elite of Birmingham to return the favor. "They can only see through white eyes," Walker explained gleefully. "They cannot distinguish even between Negro demonstrators and Negro spectators. All they know is Negroes." Connor was an arrogant man who liked to swagger around Birmingham saying, "Down here we make our own law." He sat drinking his bourbon every morning at the Moulton Hotel, loudly predicting that King would run out of niggers. Now he looked out the window and saw that King suddenly had a small army of them. Like deer, he was oblivious to the ways of those he deemed beneath him, and those imaginary 1,000 protesters were a provocation. Bull Connor had something in his mind about not letting these niggers get to City Hall, Walker said. I pray that he'd keep trying to stop us. Birmingham would have been lost if Bull had let us go down to the City Hall and pray. If he'd let us do that and stepped aside, what else would be new? There'd be no movement, no publicity. Please, Brer Connor, please, whatever you do, don't throw me in the briar patch. But of course, that's just what Connor did. A month into the protest, Walker and King stepped up the pressure. One of the Birmingham team, James Bevel, had been working with local schoolchildren, instructing them in the principles of nonviolent resistance. Bevel was a Pied Piper, a tall, bald, hypnotic speaker who wore a yarmulke and bib overalls and claimed to hear voices. McWhorter calls him a militant out of Dr. Seuss. On the last Monday in April, he dropped off leaflets at all of the black high schools around the county. Come to 16th Street Baptist Church at noon on Thursday. Don't ask permission. The city's most popular black disc jockey, Shelley the Playboy Stewart, sent out the same message to his young listeners. Kids, there's gonna be a party at the park. The FBI got wind of the plan and told Bull Connor, who announced that any child who skipped school would be expelled. It made no difference. The kids came in droves. Walker called the day the children arrived, D-Day. At 1 o'clock, the doors to the church opened, and King's lieutenants began sending the children out. They held signs saying, "Freedom," or "I'll die to make this land my home." They sang, "We shall overcome," and "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Outside the church, Connor's police officers waited. The children dropped to their knees and prayed, then filed into the open doors of the paddy wagons. Then another dozen came out. Then another dozen. And another, until Connor's men had begun to get an inkling that the stakes had been raised again. A police officer spotted Fred Shuttlesworth. "Hey, Fred, how many more have you got?" "At least 1,000 more," he replied. "God almighty," the officer said. By the end of the day, more than 600 children were in jail. The next day, Friday, was double D-Day. This time, 1,500 school children skipped school to come down to 16th Street Baptist. At 1 o'clock, they began filing out of the church. The streets surrounding Kelly Ingram Park were barricaded by police and firefighters. There was no mystery about why the firefighters had been called in. They had high-pressure hoses on their fire trucks, and water cannons, as they were also known, had been a staple of crowd control since the 1930s in the early days of Nazi Germany. Walker knew that if the demonstrations grew so large that they overwhelmed the Birmingham police, Connor would be sorely tempted to turn on the hoses. He wanted Connor to turn on the hoses. "It was hot in Birmingham," he explained. "I told Bevel to let the pep rally go on a while and let these firemen sit out there and bake in the sun until their tempers were like hair triggers." And the dogs? Connor had been itching to use the city's canine corps. Early that spring, in a speech, Connor had vowed to combat the civil rights protesters with 100 German police dogs. "I want them to see the dogs work," Connor growled as things began to get out of control in Kelly Ingram Park, and nothing made Walker happier than that. He had children marching in the streets, and now Connor wanted to let German shepherds loose on them? Everyone in King's Camp knew what it would look like if someone published a photograph of a police dog lunging at a child. Connor stood watch as the children came closer. "Do not cross," he said. "If you come any further, we will turn the fire hoses on you." Connor's jails were full. He couldn't arrest anyone else, because he had nowhere to put them. The children kept coming. The firemen were hesitant. They were not used to controlling crowds. Connor turned to the fire chief. "Turn them on or go home." The firemen turned on their monitor guns, valves that turned the spray of their hoses into a high-pressure torrent. The children clung to one another and were sent sprawling backwards. The force of the water ripped some of the marchers' shirts from their bodies and flung others against walls and doorways. Back at the church, Walker began deploying waves of children to the other end of the park to open another front. Connor had no more fire trucks, but he was determined that none of the marchers cross over into white Birmingham. "Bring the dogs," Connor ordered, calling in 8 canine units. "Why did you bring old Tiger out?" Connor shouted at one of his police officers. "Why didn't you bring a meaner dog? This one's not the vicious one." The children came closer. A German shepherd lunged at a boy. He leaned in, arms limp, as if to say, "Take me as I am." On Saturday, the picture ran on the front page of every newspaper around the country. 6. Does Wyatt Walker's behavior make you uncomfortable? James Forman, who was a key figure in the civil rights movement in those years, was with Walker when Connor first deployed the canine units. Forman says that Walker started jumping with joy. "We got a movement. We got a movement. We've had some police brutality." Forman was stunned. Walker was as aware as any of them just how dangerous Birmingham could be. He had been in the room when King gave everyone a mock eulogy. How could he be jumping up and down at the sight of protesters being attacked by police dogs? After D-Day, King and Walker heard it from all sides. The judge processing the arrested marchers said that the people who misled those kids into marching ought to be put under the jail. On the floor of Congress, one of Alabama's congressmen called the use of children shameful. The mayor of Birmingham denounced the irresponsible and unthinking agitators who were using children as tools. Malcolm X, the black activist who was in every way more radical than King, said, "Real men don't put their children on the firing line." The New York Times editorialized that King was engaged in perilous ventures in brinkmanship, and Time scolded him for using children as shock troops. The U.S. Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy, warned that school children participating in street demonstrations is a dangerous business, and said, "An injured, maimed, or dead child is a price that none of us can afford to pay." On the Friday night after the second day of children's protests, King spoke at 16th Street Baptist Church to the parents of those who had been arrested that day and the day before. They knew full well the dangers and humiliations of being a black person in Birmingham. Jesus said he'd go as far as Memphis. Can you imagine how they felt with their children at that moment languishing in Bull Connor's jails? King stood up and tried to make light of the situation. "Not only did they stand up in the water, they went under the water," he said. "And dogs? Well, I'll tell you, when I was growing up, I was dog bitten for nothing. So I don't mind being bitten by a dog for standing up for freedom." Whether or not any of the parents were buying this is unclear. King plunged on. "Your daughters and sons are in jail. Don't worry about them. They are suffering for what they believe, and they are suffering to make this nation a better nation." Don't worry about them? Taylor Branch writes that there were rumors, true and false, about rats, beatings, concrete beds, overflowing latrines, jailhouse assaults, and crude examinations for venereal disease. 75 and 80 children were packed into cells intended for 8. Some had been bussed out to the state fairground and held without food and water in stockades in the pouring rain. King's response? "Jail helps you rise above the miasma of everyday life," he said blithely. "If they want some books, we will get them. I catch up on my reading every time I go to jail." Walker and King were trying to set up that picture, the German shepherd lunging at the boy. But to get it, they had to play a complex and duplicitous game. To Bull Connor, they pretended that they had 100 times more supporters than they did. To the press, they pretended they were shocked at the way Connor let his dogs loose on their protesters, while, at the same time, they were jumping for joy behind closed doors. And to the parents whose children they were using as cannon fodder, they pretended that Bull Connor's prisons were a good place for their children to catch up on their reading. But we shouldn't be shocked by this. What other options did Walker and King have? In the traditional fable of the tortoise and the hare, told to every Western school child, the tortoise beats the hare through sheer persistence and effort. Slow and steady wins the race. That's an appropriate and powerful lesson, but only in a world where the tortoise and the hare are playing by the same rules and where everyone's effort is rewarded. In a world that isn't fair, and no one would have called Birmingham in 1963 fair, the terrapin has to place his relatives at strategic points along the racecourse. The trickster is not a trickster by nature. He is a trickster by necessity. In the next great civil rights showdown in Selma, Alabama, 2 years later, a photographer from Life magazine put down his camera in order to come to the help of children being roughed up by police officers. Afterward, King reprimanded him. "The world doesn't know this happened because you didn't photograph it. I'm not being cold-blooded about it, but it is so much more important for you to take a picture of us getting beaten up than for you to be another person joining in the fray." He needed the picture. In response to the complaints over the use of children, Fred Shuttlesworth said it best, "We got to use what we got." A dyslexic, if she or he is to succeed, is in exactly the same position, of course. That's part of what it means to be disagreeable. Gary Cohn leapt into the taxi, pretending that he knew about options trading, and it is remarkable how many successful dyslexics have had a similar moment in their careers. Brian Grazer, the Hollywood producer, got a 3-month internship after college as a clerk in the business affairs department at the Warner Brothers studio. He pushed a cart around. "I was in a big office with two union secretaries," he remembers. "My boss had worked for Jack Warner. He was putting in his last hours. He was a great guy. There was this great office there, and I said to him, 'Can I have it?' The office was bigger than my office today. He said, 'Sure, use it.' It became the Brian Grazer business. I could do my 8-hour workdays in 1 hour. I would use my office and my position to get access to all the legal contracts, business contracts, the treatments being submitted to Warner Brothers, why they passed, what they considered. I used that year to gain knowledge and information about the movie business. I would call someone every single day and I would say, 'I'm Brian Grazer. I work at Warner Brothers Business Affairs. I want to meet you.'" He was eventually fired, but only after he had stretched his 3-month term to a year and sold two ideas to NBC for $5,000 each. Grazer and Cohn, two outsiders with learning disabilities, played a trick. They bluffed their way into professions that would otherwise have been closed to them. The man in the cab assumed that no one would be so audacious as to say that he knew how to trade options if he didn't. And it never occurred to the people Brian Grazer called that when he said he was Brian Grazer from Warner Brothers, what he really meant was that he was Brian Grazer who pushes the mail cart around at Warner Brothers. What they did is not right, just as it is not right to send children up against police dogs. But we need to remember that our definition of what right is, as often as not, is simply the way that people in positions of privilege close the door on those on the outside. David has nothing to lose, and because he has nothing to lose, he has the freedom to thumb his nose at the rules set by others. That's how people with brains a little bit different from the rest of ours get jobs as options traders and Hollywood producers. And that's how a small band of protesters, armed with nothing but their wits, have a chance against the likes of Bull Connor. I still think I's de fastest runner in de world. The bewildered deer complains after a race in which Terrapin has done something that would get him banished from every competition in the world. "Maybe you are," Terrapin responds, "but I can hedge you off with sense." 7. The boy in Bill Hudson's famous photograph is Walter Gadsden. He was a sophomore at Parker High in Birmingham, 6 feet tall and 15 years old. He wasn't a marcher. He was a spectator. He came from a conservative black family that owned two newspapers in Birmingham and Atlanta that had been sharply critical of King. Gadsden had taken off school that afternoon to watch the spectacle unfolding around Kelly Ingram Park. The officer in the picture is Dick Middleton. He was a modest and reserved man. The Canine Corps, McWhorter writes, was known for attracting straight arrows who wanted none of the scams and payoffs that often came with a regular beat. Nor were the dog handlers known for being race ideologues. The dog's name is Leo. Now what happens if we look closely at the faces of the black bystanders in the background? Shouldn't they be surprised or horrified? They're not. Then there's the leash in Middleton's hand. It's taut, as if he's trying to restrain Leo. And Gadsden's left hand is not limp. He's gripping Middleton on the forearm. And Gadsden's left leg, he's kicking Leo. Gadsden would say later that he had been raised around dogs and had been taught how to protect himself. "I automatically threw my knee up in front of the dog's head," he said. Gadsden wasn't the martyr, passively leaning forward as if to say, "Take me, here I am." He's steadying himself with a hand on Middleton so he can deliver a sharper blow. The word around the movement afterward was that he'd broken Leo's jaw. Hudson's photograph is not at all what the world thought it was. It was a little bit of Brer Rabbit trickery. You got to use what you got. "Sure, people got bit by the dogs," Walker said, looking back 20 years later. "I'd say at least 2 or 3. But a picture's worth a thousand words, darling.